Chapter 3. A tyrant has fallen in the Germany of Hitler, where we have seen Dachau and Buchenwald. But I say to you that over there are hundreds of Dachaus and hundreds of Buchenwalds. Vasily Lunya. It is as if the West actually does not want to know the truth until the moment when this knowledge has ceased to be of use. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Warning: reading this chapter may be hazardous to your worldview. Writing it was to mine. What I discovered, or rather uncovered, for what I was doing was tracing references and footnotes backward along a well-mapped historical route that had simply fallen into disuse, reads like the history of a mirror image universe, certainly not like the history of the United States of America as I knew it, or even as I knew it through the distorting prism of political correctness, multiculturalism, cultural relativism, and the undermining rest. And that's saying something. I am specifically referring to a largely overlooked chain of events that took place during the span of history preceding, including, and immediately following World War II. This is the climactic era that still serves as the American touchstone, the Good War, grading term. We won, thanks to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our great, if not greatest, modern president, at least according to all of those blue ribbon polls which, unbidden, continually roll out predictable tallies of legacy, reputation, and lore. FDR is always up there with George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, the two perennial presidential medalists. Of course, when it comes to any reckoning of this era, there's no omitting Winston Churchill, the embodiment of fully half of what we still, atavistically, invoke as the special relationship between the United States and Great Britain. It would no doubt frost FDR to know that Churchill gets the moniker Man of the Century for his role in vanquishing Nazism. By the final year of the war, it seems, FDR had grown jealous and weary of Churchill, although we don't usually perceive such fissures from our rosy vantage point. Looking back, we see history aglow with their gigantic reputations, lighting a veritable Eden of patriotic unity fostered by the war against Germany and also Japan. Sometimes we almost forget about Japan, which didn't fade and fragment until the 1960s. That last point, the one about the 1960s, particularly the mid to late 1960s, marking the decisive break with all that had come before, is something I have previously tried to debunk in The Death of the Grown-Up. In this earlier book, I argue that the political, artistic, racial, sexual, and youth liberation movements, for which we remember the decade, were already underway before campus radicals took over their first building at Berkeley in 1964. For example, Playboy magazine, flagship of mainstreamed pornography, sailed forth in 1953, the year before the milestone desegregation ruling, Brown v. Board of Education. Rosa Parks took her famous bus ride 2 years later in 1955. Lady Chatterley's Lover made its unexpurgated American debut in 1959. Women were taking the pill by 1960. James Meredith was desegregating the University of Mississippi by 1961, the same year comic Lenny Bruce, born 1925, started beating obscenity raps. The Port Huron Statement, bemoaning youth's ennui, came out in 1962. By 1963, a full year before the sex, drugs, and rock and roll generation descended on Sproul Hall at Cal, Timothy Leary was booted from Harvard for promoting the use of LSD. Indeed, the logic of the timeline makes a compelling case for an essential continuity between what is remembered as having been the boring 1950s and the countercultural 1960s. How did that happen? If, under the retrospective lens, the 1950s are not as stable and normal as eyewitness accounts of Ozzie and Harriet episodes would attest, what triggered the overlooked upheaval? Something must have happened in the preceding period to lay the foundations, or better, to demolish the foundations, for what would turn out to be near total social breakdown and reconfiguration. What? It is at this junction where most of us, certainly most conservatives, the group preoccupied with this abiding cultural mystery, find ourselves stumped. We may chronicle civilizational change, note shifting fault lines of behavior, highlight their deleterious impact on society, but walking back along the trail, we hit a dead end at the basic question, why? Why did all of these things begin to happen in the first place? The common reply, I've made it myself, comes down to this. We lost our cultural confidence. We don't believe in ourselves, our values, anymore. Why don't we? There are reasons, proximate causes, economic, educational, and pop cultural developments, but no ultimate explanation. And c'est la vie just isn't enough. The fact is, the loss of cultural confidence explains many things, but it doesn't explain the loss of cultural confidence itself. Neither do theories of attrition that posit a cyclical ebb and flow by which civilizations flourish and then die off on autopilot. Such an approach rests on a non-existent natural law of inevitability, as though human beings have no more impact on forestalling or triggering the collapse of their societies than they have on forestalling or triggering sunrise. The question then becomes, what if that loss of cultural confidence weren't the result of an inevitable progression from traditional morality to cultural relativism? What if there were, in fact, some culprit or some culprit act or movement behind the downward spiral of events that has been acutely and repeatedly examined and analyzed? What if the resulting death of the grown-up were, in fact, a murder? This is the only half-whimsical conclusion I've come to since digging into some of the deeper, less accessible layers of the past, initially seeking some explanation for our chronic indifference over the demise of the Soviet Union, over the colossal transgressions of the communist system. At a certain point in this research, I found myself exploring what began to look more and more like a historical crime scene, a notion I first broached in the previous chapter. A distinct pattern of deceit emerged from heretofore invisible, unnoticed, discarded or suppressed clues, evidence overlooked or hidden so long that the criminals themselves are long forgotten. This was the perfect crime, because not only did the perpetrators get off scot-free, their crimes have never been detected. Here, in the light of information and documentation, not publicly available until 4 and 5 decades after the fact, was a cold case with quite staggering implications. And my worldview was rocked. So what was this crime of the century? Logical, reasonable question, but I find myself reluctant to pull the pin and let the bomb explode just yet. This ground requires preparation, some retracing of the steps I followed back through the evidence by which the light dawneth, revealing a ghastly scenario every American should now bear retrospective witness to. That so seriously said, I must emphasize that it was with no such foreknowledge that I set out to fill in the blanks about why it was that we had recently witnessed triumph in the Cold War abroad, the demise of what we know as the Soviet Union, anyway, even as that same Cold War at home, the riddling, corrupting drive against what we now regard as traditional morality, Enlightenment logic, and cultural memory, had gone so badly, and with strange, corrosive effects. As a result of losing, or at least not winning, the Cold War at home, according to the outline I presented to my publisher, even the overwhelming moral imperative to oppose totalitarianism as exemplified by Soviet power became a source of vague discomfort, if not outright embarrassment. Having gone through college and entered journalism during the last decade of the Cold War, this I recall personally. I wanted to probe the origins of that lurking discomfort and embarrassment, that Pavlovian trigger that always prompted a moment's hesitation or hitch discomfiting the average anti-communist on giving voice or not to the anti-communist point of view during much of the last century, at least in any circles counting as intellectual, artistic, academic, even journalistic or mainstream, read, liberal, political. These were the enlightened circles, the cool circles, clubby and powerful, in the sense of owning the dominant professional territory. Intriguingly, they also occupied, or better, seized and held, the moral high ground. Over the decades, whether the communist crime du jour was blood purge, invasion, show trial, assassination, atomic espionage, subversion, deception, treason, gulags, boat people, re-education camps, or genocide, such circles remained, at base, redoubts of a morally pristine anti-anti-communism. The bizarre effect of such non-sullyable purity was to take all the crimes of communism or of a communist agent right off the table, simultaneously thrusting the nearest anti-communist into the hot seat. Epically, Whittaker Chambers experienced the same syndrome at its punishing extreme. Chambers, probably the most famous American ex-communist ever, was a former courier for Soviet military intelligence, subsequently an editor at Time magazine, and, in passing, curiously, the English translator of the 1923 Austrian novel Bambi, which became the 1942 Disney cartoon. His exceedingly wise decision to retain hard evidence attesting to his espionage work in the 1930s helped convict, most sensationally, Alger Hiss, the Ivy League-educated, well-connected former State Department official and progenitor of the United Nations, president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and all-around poster boy of the liberal establishment. Starting in 1950, Hiss served 4 years in jail for perjury charges related to Soviet espionage. Then what happened? Did a thankful President Truman crown Chambers in laurels and congratulate him on behalf of a grateful nation for exposing a communist conspiracy metastasizing at the highest levels of the federal government? Never has a simple no been less adequate. Fortunately for us, Chambers' 1952 landmark book, Witness, explains in painstaking and also painful detail the cauterizing ordeal he underwent for what was widely and weirdly regarded as his own crime of calling out the communist machine. At one point in his testimonial, Chambers encapsulates the physics of anti-anti-communism this way. I had been warned repeatedly that the brunt of official wrath was directed not against Alger Hiss as a danger, but against me for venturing to testify to the danger. It bears restating. Officialdom was enraged not by the danger posed by Hiss, a Soviet military intelligence agent, continuously since 1935, but by Chambers for testifying to the danger. This may be a pattern familiar since Cassandra, but it repeats itself with frantic frequency throughout the past century, up to and beyond when Ronald Reagan named the Soviet Empire evil, and the world expressed more outrage over the phrase evil empire than over the evil of the empire itself. Of course, Reagan was president. Chambers was nobody. For him, the brunt of official wrath meant the vengeful response of the Truman administration, beginning with a statement from Truman himself in which he famously dismissed the whole case against Hiss as a red herring. This, Chambers would later write, was the most unexpected and, to me, the most stunning development of all. As stunning as the drive against putting communism on trial coming from the West would be 40 years later. Important to note is that with a twist of the timeline, Chambers could just as easily have been subjected to the wrath of the Roosevelt administration or the wrath of the Eisenhower administration. Both of these administrations shared with Truman's the same propensity for suppression when it came to the touchy subject of domestic communist conspiracy. In the end, this had the effect of protecting the communist conspiracy itself. In FDR's case, for example, the president personally tried to shut down Representative Martin Dye's investigations into communist conspiracy and later his political career. In Eisenhower's case, as president, he was personally involved in efforts to shut down Senator Joseph McCarthy's quite similar investigations. In all such cases, as with the Hiss case, this meant that both the extent and the impact of the conspiracies were officially downplayed, denied, suppressed, and/or ignored by those elected leaders directly responsible for defending the Constitution. In each and every instance, it was the anti-communists, the ex-communists, and the Cassandras who were punished and castigated by the Washington establishment and then ostracized for their crimes of exposing treason. Why? This question drove me further past the pat narratives that have sufficed for too long. It is particularly pertinent today as we watch the same establishment forces coalescing anew to suppress logical and indeed patriotic questions about hostile Islamic penetration of the U.S. government, particularly since 9/11. When did this ugly stuff really get going? A related question. When did anti-communism itself, the philosophical and political drive against state domination of the individual, become a radioactive inheritance of perceived bigotry and mass hysteria to be passed down, gingerly, generation to generation? It must be here where the origins of our indifference to the plight of the anti-communist witnesses and to Cold War victory and communist crime lie. What I was looking for, then, was the beginnings of the greatest propaganda coup and flim-flam operation in history, the hocus-pocus transformation of liberty-loving anti-communism into a force of repression to be reviled, not always by the people who were reflexively anti-communist, but certainly by the elite expression of public conscience. There was a flip side to the phenomenon, too, the hocus-pocus transformation of totalitarian communism into a force of liberalism, later liberation, to be shielded or even fully embraced by that same public conscience. It was almost as if a giant syringe of Novocaine had been injected into the body politic at some unknown point and with permanent effect. The numbed sensibility that reflexively reviles the evil of Hitler but calmly accepts that of Stalin, Mao, and other red thugs and killers. Among the many manifestations of this weirdly insensate state, my symbolic favorite is the eye-catching frequency with which Warhol's silkscreen of Chairman Mao pops up as an aspect of chic in lavishly decorated homes, glorious fruits of the free-ish market, as celebrated in four-color, glossy shelter magazines. And no, irony is not a fig leaf for the mass murderer over the mantelpiece. His pride of place is more evidence of internal rot and betrayal. The so-called McCarthy era is the obvious place to search for answers, since the narrative we can all recite tells us that the red-hunting Republican senator from Wisconsin was himself single-handedly responsible for the evisceration of ideological opposition to communism, anti-communism, rendering said anti-communism into a kind of disease. The remedy was said to be a steadying dose of anti-anti-communism, despite the often heavy pro-communist side effects. McCarthy accomplished all of this, the same narrative goes, with his crude zealotry and wild overreach, hectoring and destroying American innocents who had the misfortune to be dragged before his investigatory Senate committee for nothing. Name one communist or Soviet agent ever identified by McCarthy, goes the perpetual challenge to this day, regardless of evidence from both Soviet and American archives that corroborate FBI reports, sworn testimonies, and other facts amassed in support of innumerable McCarthy investigations into the Soviet penetration of the federal government. In 2014, McCarthy biographer M. Stanton Evans set out to create a table of suspects who came before McCarthy and his committee who turned out to be Soviet agents, communists, or who pleaded the Fifth Amendment when asked about such matters. Evans stopped when he had identified 50. Nonetheless, the accusatory catchphrase, "Have you left no sense of decency?" still vibrates tremulously on a historical wavelength of inexhaustible outrage. The sequence of events, however, suggests a rat. 2 years before McCarthy's 1950 kickoff speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, ex-communist couriers Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley had already struck body blows for exposure, breaking the communist creed of omerta, mob silence, in separate public appearances before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. They had both already been extensively debriefed by the FBI starting in 1945. The committee itself had already been up and running for a decade. In other words, as the seminal, groundbreaking, and essential, blacklisted by history, the untold story of Senator Joe McCarthy and his fight against America's enemies by M. Stanton Evans makes clear, anti-communism was in bad odor with the powers that be and make noise long before McCarthy decried still unaddressed security risks inside the State Department in his 1950 speech. In certain ways, McCarthy's investigations might almost be seen as the end of something, not the beginning, the end phase of an arduous anti-communist effort to demonstrate once and for all not just the existence of domestic communist incursions, but also the reluctance of the federal government under both Democrats and Republicans to do anything about it. With the political fall of McCarthy, the brief, intense popularity enjoyed by anti-communist investigations came to a halt. Still, investigations would grind on for another highly productive 20 years in both the House Committee on Un-American Activities and the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security and elsewhere, where McCarthy never played a role. Following the invention of dread McCarthyism, however, these investigations always seemed to begin from a defensive crouch. More relevant to the search for origins, then, might be the precedent set by Martin Dies, the House Democrat from Texas, who in 1938 founded what would be known as the House Committee on Un-American Activities, or under his chairmanship, which lasted until 1944, the Dies Committee. Before Joe McCarthy, there was Martin Dies, Evans writes. Virtually everything that would later be said about Joe McCarthy was said first of Martin Dies, that he was conducting witch hunts, smearing innocent victims, using the communist issue to advance his own malign agenda, spreading hysteria about a non-existent menace. It was the same routine from start to finish. Pre-McCarthy witch hunts in 1938? I promptly began mining Evans's footnotes for related material. These included The Red Decade by Eugene Lyons, Martin Dies' Story by Martin Dies, and The Red Plot Against America by Robert E. Stripling. Or rather, across the Stripling book's red cover, emblazoned in white capitals with black contrast, The Red Plot Against America. In smaller letters, the author's name, Robert E. Stripling, Chief Investigator, House Un-American Activities Committee, 1938 to 1948. The rest of the cover of the old book was equally striking, jarring even to the modern eye. Standing out on a red and black map of the outline of the USA is a white hammer and sickle from which phrases explode like rays. In the White House, in labor, in the State Department, in Hollywood. What was that faint noise I thought I heard as I examined the cover art? Was it the sound of snickers? Ah, communists under every bed! Catcalls? Dirty, rotten commies! It was almost as if some late-night host, deadpan, held up this relic of the Red Scare before the cameras without comment, prompting his ever-prime studio audience to let off guffaws on cue. I know those guffaws. They're born of conditioning over several generations to regard a red plot against America as something so ridiculous as to be utterly laughable and beyond all reason. Close-minded, too, and even indecent. From this same bent of mind, this same consensus, came the establishment ire at Whitaker Chambers in 1948, not at Alger Hiss. Outrage over the evil empire label by Ronald Reagan in 1983, not the USSR. And, more recently, ridicule over but also suppression of the Marxist inclinations and associations of candidate Obama in 2008. They didn't really surface at all in 2012. More official outrage welled up again against Representative Michelle Bachmann for raising elementary questions about Muslim Brotherhood penetration of the U.S. government in 2012. The same routine from start to finish. Even if I was prepared for this McCarthy revisited routine, make that McCarthy pre-visited routine, I was still taken aback by the bitterness with which Stripling recounts the decade he served as the chief investigator for the Un-American Activities Committee. I want to tell in detail the price that men must pay for the dubious privilege of being reviled in print and on the air, he writes, for their labors in what amounts to a necessary sewer project of communist investigations. This is his attempt to outline, without conjecture, the scope of the communist conspiracy against the government and people of the United States, he writes, although to do so is to invite the charges of fascist, red-baiter, witch-hunter, smear artist. To fail to do so is to capitulate to a resourceful enemy who can endure any counterattack except exposure. There are those words again. Fascist, red-baiter, witch-hunter. And there is that same soft spot of exposure again, the desperate trigger of character assassination by poisonous invective. This lexicon of political profanity developed to enforce what ex-socialist journalist Eugene Lyons called the irrational and indefensible taboo against criticizing the great experiment in Stalin's Russia or its extensions and machinations in our own country. Like today's cries of Islamophobia, like the still current cry of McCarthyism, the cry of red-baiting in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s denoted taboo, requiring an immediate cease to all debate, and thus a continued block against exposure. Interestingly enough, Stripling notes that Dyes Committee investigations into German, Japanese, and Italian subversive activities in the run-up to World War II were widely lauded, even inspiring government action, as when an investigation into Adolf Hitler's use of German diplomatic and consular officers as spies in this country led FDR to shut German consulates down. But, Stripling continues, whenever we cast an inquiring eye on the equally subversive activities of the Communist Party, we were instantly assailed, though the strongest microscope could not differentiate between the nature of the party's conspiracy and that of the Germans, Japanese, and Italians. Lyons, too, observed the same double standard at work, noting the favorable reception studies of fascism and Nazism in America typically received. We have yet to hear their authors denounced as brown-baiters, black-baiters, or silver-baiters, he writes, noting the colors adopted by fascist and Nazi followers. On the contrary, the charges against fascists and Nazis are assayed on the basis of their truth or falsity. They are not arbitrarily dismissed with a hackneyed epithet. There is yet among us, it happens, no taboo against examining and, if necessary, condemning the operation of Mussolini, Hitler, and their direct or indirect agents. Not so communism in the 1930s, Lyons's Red Decade, or the 1940s, which Stripling would look back on noting. Of course, we fully expected to be smeared by leading communists and by the Daily Worker and its abusive carbon copies. But we did not expect what often became an avalanche of abuse from more conservative quarters, from men as high in public esteem as Franklin D. Roosevelt. Neither Stripling nor Dyes was prepared for this realization as they encountered active White House hostility to the committee's anti-communist activities. A decade later, Whitaker Chambers wasn't prepared for it either. I doubt Joseph McCarthy knew what he was heading into later still. In his memoir, Martin Dyes describes a chance meeting he had with McCarthy and his wife-to-be, Jean Kerr, at the venerable and vanished Harvey's Restaurant, which used to stand next door to Washington's Mayflower Hotel on Connecticut Avenue. It was 1952, and Dyes had just been reelected to the House of Representatives after an 8-year hiatus. McCarthy would soon become chairman of the Senate Committee on Government Operations and, as Dyes put it, contemplated investigating communism. Matter of fact, Dyes wrote, Joe wanted suggestions and advice. Did the world hang in the balance for a pregnant pause while a trial by fire was ignited by bolts of lightning in the gathering storm, or something? Dyes doesn't mention augurs of heaven or hell. He continued, I told him of my own experiences and warned him to expect abuse, ridicule, and every known device of character assassination and mental torture. I told him to move cautiously until he was sure of his footing, to beware of unsupported charges that would soon be flooding his offices, and never to underestimate the cleverness and resourcefulness of the communists and their fellow travelers. Clearly, at least clearly at a remove of more than half a century, this was war. A hidden army was in place, a secret insurgency, and much of the local population was sympathetic or even in league with it. When McCarthy came along, as M. Stanton Evans documents, he was entirely correct to suspect, track, and attempt to expose the extensive and ongoing conspiracy that Dyes had probed before him, that Chambers had participated in and witnessed, that official Washington, for reasons to be discussed, none of them good, sought to keep under wraps. The historical fact is, secret Soviet forces had made massive incursions into the federal government following FDR's first election in 1932 and reached every kind of inner sanctum during the United States wartime alliance with the Soviet Union between 1941 and 1945. The one really and truly special relationship, as I have learned. As Evans lays out in detail, much of it drawn from newly declassified FBI and Senate records, the United States wasn't just riddled by communist agents. We were, for all intents and purposes, occupied by a small army being just what this kind of war requires. Expert estimates now peg the number of Americans assisting Soviet intelligence agencies during the 1930s and 1940s as exceeding 500. Not one Aldrich Ames, not two Rosenbergs, not five magnificent Cambridgers, more than 500 willing and variously able American traders, many operating at the very highest levels of the federal government, with who knows how many more in support roles. This was a national security fiasco of a magnitude that has never, ever entered national comprehension. There is something else Evans makes clear that must be understood, what he calls the parlous state of the historical record. It turns out that the historical record, our historical record, is in fragments. Much of it still remains classified. That which is declassified remains heavily censored. Other parts of the record, thousands of intercepted Soviet cables that make up the so-called Venona Project, for example, have never been decrypted and deciphered, while we, the people, have no way of knowing whether everything decrypted and deciphered from Venona has in fact been released. Meanwhile, the identities of numerous Soviet agents whose activities are tracked in Venona cables remain unknown. Salient among the mysteries of Venona are the hundreds of unbroken cryptonyms that stud the cables, protecting the identities of agents and informants even when the messages have been deciphered, wrote U.S. Air Force historian Edward Mark. In other words, we still don't fully know what, or even who, hit us. There are other stunning gaps in the record that became evident to Evans as he attempted to assemble his own McCarthy archive of primary sources. For example, on many occasions he discovered that some person or persons unknown had preceded him on this document hunt to delete the record. This had the unmistakable effect, if not also the intent, of thwarting or at least delaying Evans' plans. Scads of primary sources, dozens of State Department documents pertaining to Soviet penetration, letters listing communist security risks from the Senate and the CIA, even newspapers of the era, have selectively vanished from their archival repositories. In one instance, Evans was searching for a memorandum by a State Department official named Samuel Klaus. The 106-page memorandum, written in 1946, listed and detailed security risks at State, including names of suspected Soviet agents on the department payroll. A copy of this document, at McCarthy's behest, was obtained by a Senate committee in 1950. Today, neither the original State Department document nor the Senate's copy is to be found. At the National Archives, Evans discovered a letter of transmittal attesting to the memo's entry into the Senate committee's files and an index listing the memo in Klaus's personal papers. In both cases, in the Senate committee files and the Klaus files, the document was gone. Another example. When Evans traveled to Wheeling, West Virginia, to examine the Intelligencer's coverage of the famous and famously disputed February 1950 speech McCarthy gave in town, kicking off the McCarthy era, Evans was directed to the local library where the newspaper archives on microfilm are stored. There, Evans discovered that the newspaper editions for January and February 1950, and only those editions, were missing from the collection. Incredibly, it was the same creepy story at the Library of Congress. Those same Wheeling Intelligencer editions had vanished. Sandy Berger may be the first man to become famous for scrubbing the archives to set the record crooked, but he is far from the first. Who were these secret thieves of history? Anti-McCarthy authors protecting their phony turf from marauding facts? Soviet spies? The relative of an erstwhile security risk seeking to protect grandma or grandpa from infamy for the ages? These mysteries endure. While some primary documents have made all too easy pickings in open archives, others remain overly protected. Declassified FBI files, which Evans describes as a treasure trove of information on communist penetration of American life and institutions, suspects tracked down by the Bureau, countermeasures taken, and related topics, remain heavily censored. In case after significant case, Evans writes, including the most famous investigations into communist activities of high-ranking government officials such as Alger Hiss at the State Department, Lachlan Curry at the White House, and Harry Dexter White at Treasury, entries have been held back or heavily redacted or blacked out, sometimes for dozens of pages at a stretch. Much more remains classified and thus under government lock and key. Evans writes, without the documents referred to, and without the items blacked out in the records, attempts to chronicle our domestic Cold War, while not entirely futile, are subject to the most serious limits. This is astonishing. After all, we are not talking about 3,000-year-old cuneiform tablets, fragments of ancient papyrus, or shards of pre-Columbian pottery. These are essential documents of relatively recent vintage. They date back to an era some of us were actually born into, and some of us still predate. It was concurrent with radar, sonar, atomic energy, and the jet engine, not to mention good old Smith Corona typewriters and carbon paper, and it featured functioning institutions equipped with archivists and protocols for record keeping and the like. There is simply no good reason for these missing links, nor is there any sound purpose for the U.S. government's continuing to withhold so much evidence from us, the people. There must be a reason and purpose behind the continued secrecy, but it is neither good nor sound. That's because such secrecy only preserves the life of the lies that the release of the documents would destroy. From what you might still call the communist perspective, there remains every reason and purpose to keep the historical record hidden. That's because it is by now an observable axiom. The more the tightly held record is dislodged from secret archives at home and abroad, even piecemeal, requiring both the analytical and foraging talents of scholar detectives like M. Stanton Evans, the more once reviled anti-communists, such as Martin Dies, such as Whitaker Chambers, such as Joseph McCarthy, are vindicated, and the more the false narrative we have been taught as truth is debunked as communist agitprop. The kind of document poaching Evans discovered in his own hunt for the record and the continuing government-sealed secrecy only benefit that same other side. Evans observes, "It's not too much to say that the loss of so many primary records has created a kind of black hole of anti-knowledge in which strange factoids and curious fables circulate without resistance." Maybe in this black hole of anti-knowledge lies the epicenter of American betrayal. Of course, Evans' entire book stands as a bold correction of such anti-knowledge. With hard-won facts, he reconstructs McCarthy's career without the dirty smears that the establishment used to depict the cavemen in the sewer, as Evans describes the elite consensus on McCarthy, that red-hunting monster of the liberal demonology, who preyed on such pure souls of chivalric progressivism that they were besmirched even by proximity to his fetid clutches. On the contrary, it is a singular American patriot who emerges from Evans' efforts, a genuine martyr, the proverbial lightning rod, who withstood, for as long as he humanly could, the surging currents of the death house switch, as flipped by the most genteel and privileged members of the attack left. I've read that last sentence over several times just to make sure the metaphor hasn't taken on an overly vivid life of its own, too independent of the thought process that inspired it. No, it hasn't. The sentence conveys what I consider to be the appropriate intensity. McCarthy was a patriot. McCarthy was a martyr. As a colossal and popular force of exposure, the Gallup poll ranked him the fourth most admired man in America at the beginning of 1954. McCarthy had to be utterly and completely neutralized, then destroyed. Just as there was extreme caricature in his demonization, there should be an operatic flourish to his redemption. He deserves it. But McCarthy remains a special case. Historical reevaluation continues to pass him by. Evans' tome, the most obvious exception, in most of what might be termed post-Venona exposure research. Conducted by scholars and intelligence historians, such research counters the bulk of the anti-knowledge still circulating about Soviet espionage, infiltration, and subversion in the West by providing new proofs of their existence from previously unavailable archival materials. McCarthy himself, the man best remembered and worst damned for his efforts to expose this same espionage, infiltration, and subversion, remains history's lost man. Events recede and conditions change. The forbidding Berlin Wall, for example, became rubble, marketed as souvenirs. But the venomous sting of McCarthy, or rather McCarthyism, remains as deadly as ever. Evans explains the reluctance to reevaluate McCarthy's role as an anti-communist warrior. Such reluctance to tackle McCarthy in light of the new information may seem odd, but it is understandable in context. McCarthyism is the third rail in Cold War historiography and of our political discourse in general, and any contact with it could prove fatal to writers trying to get their work accepted in academic or mainstream media circles. Any contact could prove fatal. This should tell us the war isn't over, not by a long shot. This should tell us it goes on, now, against an enemy who still controls vital territory, academic or mainstream media circles, to such a degree that research diverging from this party line cannot be published without dire consequences to the author. That's because the cause these remnant or reflexive anti-anti-communists championed in the absence, or rather the suppression of the facts, has never been discredited to a point of acknowledged surrender. On the contrary, having successfully warded off attacks of the facts, led by individuals of singular courage, having successfully maintained the vacuum of deception, they long ago usurped the prerogative of the victor, the writing of history, to produce the anti-history we rely on to this day. McCarthy bad. Communists good and or non-existent. Anti-communism terrible. Who cares what Venona says outside of a few academics? Have you left no sense of decency? To put it another way, there was a certain magnificence in its unabridged cynicism, its defiance of common sense. The roles of leading historical figures were perverted or altogether erased. New roles were invented for others. All books, articles, documents, museum materials which contradicted this extraordinary fantasy parading as history, and that means nearly all historical and political writings and documentation, disappeared throughout the country. All true, an apt description of the replacement of facts with false narrative. However, this heated passage addresses something else entirely. The sweeping, devastating psychological impact of the publication of The History of the Communist Party, a 1938 work of propaganda by the Soviet government. The description is by Viktor Kravchenko, who, by my count, became perhaps only the third or fourth Soviet regime defector in American history when, in the summer of 1944, he walked away from his privileged position as an economic attaché with the Soviet Government Purchasing Commission at 3355 16th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., the Soviet administrative hub of Lend-Lease to the USSR. His purpose? To contribute his first-hand knowledge of communist crime to the FBI. Obviously, in the above excerpt from his 1946 international bestseller, I Chose Freedom, he didn't have the American history of the Cold War in mind, particularly as it had yet to unfold. Still, when I read Evans's description of Cold War anti-history, it was Kravchenko's words that I heard, sounding a jarringly concordant note. Kravchenko continues, describing the Soviet regime's rewrite of Russian history. Shamelessly, without so much as an explanation, it revised half a century of Russian history. I don't mean simply that it falsified some facts or gave a new interpretation of events. I mean that it deliberately stood history on its head, expunging events and inventing facts. It twisted the recent past, a past still fresh in millions of memories, into new and bizarre shapes to conform with the version of affairs presented by blood-purged trials and the accompanying propaganda. As the previous chapter attests, I have never been one for mirror imagery that regards the United States and Soviet Union as equivalents or geopolitical twins of any kind. At the same time, I can't now ignore disturbing parallels that exist between Kravchenko's description of Soviet propaganda as history and, beginning with this period of Soviet infiltration under consideration, American history as Soviet propaganda. Given what we now know, both from old evidence and new, it is this inversion of our own history that requires rapt attention. Of course, what distinguishes the two national rewrites of history is blood, a factor of a colossal differentiation, but also a puzzlement. That is, how is it that mere propaganda, sans force or threat of the gulag, was enough to stand our history on its head? Mulling the landmark works of historical correction assembled since the 1990s by John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clare, Christopher Andrew and Vasily Matrokin, Herbert Rommerstein and Eric Brindell, Alan Weinstein and Alexander Vasiliev, Gerald and Leona Schechter, and more, it becomes painfully clear that Kravchenko's contemptuous description of the communist narrative as bold, specious, consciousless fiction and extraordinary fantasy parading as history quite aptly defines what we naively regard as our own transparent, truthful, good-faith narrative. The citizens of this country have been deceived on a massive scale, often by the U.S. government, regarding the reach and impact of the secret war of aggression the USSR waged in the United States with American proxies. Not all of us were deceived, of course. Publicly available evidence was voluminous from the start, becoming a colossal and ever-expanding dossier of eyewitness testimonies and investigations, proof of the reality that somehow, again how, faded away while a vivid and grotesque fantasy lived on. Kravchenko describes the Soviet process by which reality in his homeland disappeared, a process that included the physical removal of the very officials and staff who had presided over Communist Party doctrine and propaganda in the first place. He writes, "To brand the shame more deeply on our minds, study of the new version was made obligatory for all responsible party people. History classes met nearly every night in this period, and lectures from Sverdlovsk came to our town to help hammer home the lies, while most of us fumed inwardly. Whatever human dignity remained in our character was humiliated, but even the most gigantic lie, by dint of infinite repetition, takes root. Stalin knew this before Hitler discovered it. As I looked on, I could see terrible falsehoods, at first accepted under pressure, become established as unquestioned facts, particularly among younger people without personal experience to the contrary, to bother them. It can't happen here, right? Nevertheless, something very much like it did happen here, and is still happening. From the schoolroom, where political correctness dictates curriculum, to the workplace, where sensitivity training conditions behavioral and thought patterns that didn't take back in school. The communist origins, the communist inspiration for this top-down transformation of the human condition may be the ultimate secret that the archives have disgorged, even as it sits raw and unclaimed in plain sight." Of course, there was so much else to see after the Soviet government dissolved on December 25, 1991, and select Soviet archives opened, briefly, to eager scholars. The earliest forays into the stacks were transformational for many, leading John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clair, for example, to publish The Secret World of American Communism in 1995, a book in which they revealed the existence of an archive of evidence in the USSR, confirming what Cold Warriors had been arguing, shouting, for decades, that the Communist Party in America had maintained an underground arm, a fact long denied by many historians. The word denied, of course, doesn't begin to conjure the adamantine refusals of many historians who, kicking and screaming, failed to face already overwhelming evidence to the contrary, and still do. There was more. This American communist underground, in the words of Haynes and Clair, cooperated with Soviet intelligence in espionage against the United States, while the CPUSA, as a whole, was indeed a fifth column working inside and against the United States in the Cold War. Like a Soviet Frankenstein, the CPUSA was the creation of Moscow masters, and now, finally, there was overwhelming documentary proof to see at the source. To say Cold Warriors knew such things all along is to miss the devastating point. For the 40 years since the end of World War II, or, to use that more instructive historical marker, for the 62 years since the United States recognized the USSR in 1933 in exchange for promises that the Soviet Union would not wage a clandestine war against the United States from within, this crucial fact of Soviet-directed subversion was, to varying degrees, in play, contested, derided, denied. The anti-anti-communists denied it existed. The anti-communists argued that it did exist, suffering the slings and arrows, witch-hunters, red-baiters, of outrageous slander. What is worse, however, is the discovery that the U.S. government, almost from the start, knew the truth about the existence of the communist conspiracy, having amassed its own evidence, a secret archive of irrefutable documentary confirmation of Soviet-orchestrated espionage. These top-secret decryptions of intelligence cables from KGB agents in Washington and New York to superiors in Moscow between 1943 and 1948 would become known to the public as the Venona Archive, but not until 1995, and only after findings from Soviet archives had already begun to be published. Question: why did the U.S. government allow this destructive, corrosive civil war? The debate over whether communist conspiracy existed to rage on even as it continued to enlarge its own secret archive of proof. On this crucial question, there is mainly conjecture about what was for 50 years an unbroken wall of official silence. Like all such silence, it only served the communist conspiracy itself, the other side, desperate to shield itself from all glints of light on its treasonous activities. Typically, intelligence historians make only desultory arguments to justify the U.S. government's silence was golden policy. But I'm not buying. Since the rationales the experts offer are speculation, we don't have to. What do you do with the disturbing evidence brought forward by Gerald and Leona Schechter and reinvestigated and affirmed by the late Robert Novak that Harry S. Truman, for example, was informed as early as 1950 that findings from the Venona Project confirmed both Assistant Treasury Secretary Harry Dexter White and former State Department official Alger Hiss as Soviet agents? The Schechters further reveal that, according to their source, a select group of Washington movers and shakers were similarly informed of Venona's early findings. Included in this group was Philip Graham, publisher of the Washington Post, the newspaper Whitaker Chambers would later describe as the most implacable of the pro-Hiss newspapers. Haynes and Clare reject this hypothesis. If true, however, this means the brunt of official wrath that Chambers and other anti-communists continued to bear could not have arisen from official ignorance. Suddenly, we have evidence of a deeply troubling level of official complicity in the communist conspiracy of silence. Why would Truman and later Eisenhower have done nothing with the Venona revelations? Why would they have uniformly failed to reveal the truth and disperse the political poison in the body politic? These aren't just questions about what took the government so long. They are more urgently questions about what moral compass, what petty political considerations, allowed these powerful men to permit American citizens such as Chambers, Bentley, and many, many others, including their defenders, elected representatives, lawmen, investigators, and journalists, not to mention anti-communist citizens and refugees, to be pilloried, undermined, and personally destroyed, hounded from a public square, scrubbed clean of the truth. What role, if any, did the communist penetration of the U.S. government play in their decision to prolong the confusion and subterfuge? What does the extent of this penetration mean for our own history? Or rather, what we have always thought of as our own history, but which clearly was rather more intertwined with that of our main adversary than we have previously understood. Assessing the impact, the effect, the toll of the penetration is the vital exercise that is long overdue. Even the most virtuosic intelligence researchers, perhaps concentrated as they are on locating, extracting, verifying, analyzing, and assembling the data themselves, seem loath to attempt this. Indeed, the grand historical impact of the very subversive activities they labor to chronicle, working from clues and secrets as cryptic as those of ancient civilizations, is left more or less hanging. Of course, maybe grand historical impact isn't part of their job description. Or maybe they, too, remain subject to the false framework in which the focal point of controversy turns narrowly on whether active Soviet espionage networks existed in the United States in the first place. Anti-communists recognized all along that they did indeed exist and tried to expose them. Anti-anti-communists swore all along that they didn't or didn't amount to much and attacked the anti-communists for their efforts. This particular argument is now settled once and for all and spread the word. In their monumental 2009 book, Spies, The Rise and Fall of the KGB in America, Haynes Clare and Alexander Vasiliev, for example, after nearly two decades of research, arrive at the bottom line, literally, on page 548, the final page of their book. It was no witch hunt that led American counterintelligence officials to investigate government employees and others with access to sensitive information for communist ties, but a rational response to the extent to which the Communist Party had become an appendage of Soviet intelligence. And, as the documents in Vasiliev's notebooks make plain, they only knew the half of it. It was no witch hunt. It was a rational response. They only knew the half of it. With these very simple sentences, a universe, if not a galaxy, is inverted, or rather is turned right side up again. End of book, end of story. But isn't something missing? Aren't some apologies in order? Some rather extravagant wreaths of orchids and rosebuds for the lonely graves of unsung heroes. Putrid heaps of scorn to dump liberally on the heads of their tormentors. The fact is, under the sheer and unstoppable weight of the new evidence, a war has reversed outcomes. Due to fresh and confirming documentation, a verdict of history has been overturned. However, there has been no real reckoning, no tangible crystallization, no click of realignment, no truth commission, and no mea culpas. A most extensive pattern of Soviet infiltration is a documented fact, but the old pantomime goes on even as it no longer makes sense on its own terms. McCarthy bad, communists good and or non-existent, anti-communism terrible. Venona is interesting in everything, but have you left no sense of decency? The pretense will endure as long as we allow it to, until the point arrives at which we finally dare face the logical implications of these newly minted, polished, glittering, glaring, blinding facts. Their implications being what precisely? Their implications being that for many crucial years, American statecraft was an instrument of Soviet strategy.